Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Yes, we're recording on Monday morning. So this is kind of like a husband and wife team. We're going to start with Lynn Ekdahl. Lynn Ekdahl is actually married to our first guest, Mel Goodman, but she also is a fabulous political poet. And she sent me a poem the other day, and I thought, well, this is a perfect time to start my show with what she actually wrote. It's entitled, Stay in the Race. Stay in the race, oh Nikki, please, and the Donald poke and tease. You know how he reacts to pokes. He can't absorb like other folks. He has to fulminate and flail, thinks his enemies will quail. And for the most part, that they do. The ones who don't are very few. He'd love to have you done and gone. He hates that you're still hanging on. He attacks you, calls you names, says you have a bird-like brain. His fulminations and his lies seem to make his humerus rise. His face contorts, he splits and spews, and if he's blown a crucial fuse, his mental state he often loses, and his targets he confuses. As he rails and as he rants, he claims that you're Pelosi, Nancy? So, Nikki, if you just hang on, Trump might end up being gone. To you, they could the prize be handing, because you will be the last gal standing. Oh, well, I don't think it's necessary for 2024, but it's definitely, it's like she's looking at 2028. Joining me right now is the spouse of that fabulous political poet, Mel Goodman. Mel Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst. He's the author of a number of books, including his most recent book, American Carnage, The Wars of Donald Trump, and Containing the National Security State. Goodman is the national security columnist for counterpunch.org. And the title of your piece, and I'm not sure I agree with you, but I want to have you pitch it, is Why Are regional experts expecting more war in every corner? Welcome back to the program, Mr. Goodman, and thank you for being married to Lynn Ekdahl. That's
thank
all I have
you.
To say.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I feel like everything is a tinderbox right now. The politics in America is a tinderbox. I keep imagining a civil war. Okay, I'm looking at what's happening at the border. I'm imagining another sort of, you know, I mean, they might as well secede because they're on their way to it. Then I look at what's going on in Israel, and then I just look at what's going on between Ukraine and Russia, and I just feel like we're all so brittle. It's not that we want something. It's not that we have to anticipate something. But you and I both know, what starts a conflagration is not always what's expected or predicted. It sometimes is something that's arbitrary. And I just feel like we're in such a world where that kind of arbitrary could happen and the kindling is there.
Well, I think of World War I, and I think of Barbara Tuchman's wonderful book, The Guns of August, about the war no one really wanted and very few had prepared for. And then we were in World War I, which made no sense whatsoever. Now we're talking about the same thing. No one wants war, it seems. We're claiming we don't want war. Iran says they don't want war. We say we're not escalating. Well, actually, we've created this strategic trap that we're in. And there are a couple ways out of it. Talking to Iran would be one way to lessen the tension in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. The war in Gaza must end. And Secretary of State Blinken's trips. He's now on his fifth trip to the Middle East or going nowhere. He's taking messages to Netanyahu that Netanyahu is not receiving. If you don't get tough with Israel, you're not going to get anywhere with them. And getting tough would mean cutting off the military aid, the free military support that he gets. But then we have to focus on our own contribution to this strategic trap, which is putting these small military
bases,
or yeah. They're not even bases, they're yeah. just facilities or logistics points right. In places where they can't be guarded, where they're targets. So we have hundreds of people in Jordan, and they were attacked. And we have 2,500 in Iraq and 900 in Syria. We have to withdraw these troops on the ground. We have huge military bases in the Persian Gulf. It's not that we're weak in the Persian Gulf. We have a huge base at Bahrain, a huge base in Qatar. So if we need military force, which we tend to overuse anyway, we have the land-based air and the sea-based air to do what we need to do. And what I'm hoping, even though there's no evidence for that whatsoever, but what I'm hoping is that we're engaging in these retaliatory strikes to prepare our way to withdrawal, that Biden is still dealing with the grief on the withdrawal from Afghanistan, Which obviously did not go well, but he had to do it. We didn't need to be in Afghanistan for 20 years, and he was the only one who had the guts and the sense to get the hell out of there. Well, we said 12 years ago we were going to pivot from the Middle East and go into the Indo-Pacific region, but the Middle East has remains a briar patch for the United States. But one thing we could do is get these forces out of Jordan, Syria, and Iraq. What we've forgotten and no one talks about is we opened the door to Iran to come into Iraq with the stupid and mindless invasion of
Course.
Iraq in 2003, which was totally deceitful and duplicitous on George Bush's part. There were no weapons of mass destruction, and there were known that there were no weapons of mass destruction. This turned Iraq over to Iran. Iran is not going to surrender this gain, and Iraq seems content with the Shia government now in place to have this relationship with Iran. So I don't know what our troops are doing there. We say we're going after the Islamic State. Well, the Islamic State's biggest enemy is Iran. Why can't we talk to Iran on the basis of what to do about the Islamic State that doesn't involve American troops in Iraq and Syria? So there's things that we could do in a back channel way, if not more openly, with Iran that no one is talking about. We're running around talking to people we have no influence over. Blinken's talking to the Saudis. He's talking to the Egyptians. He's talking to the Jordanians. The only country we need to be talking to right now is Iran. And the only country we need to be lecturing right now is
Is
Israel.
Israel.
Because I think Netanyahu is now brain dead. What they're doing in Gaza now is horrific and horrendous. It is a war crime. It is genocide. Who are the Israelis kidding and denying the verdict of the International Court of Justice? Of course, it's the conditions of genocide. And you still have civilians dying. Since the International Court of Justice ruled, nearly 1,000 Palestinians have been killed. One of the worst things I read is children are arriving at the hospitals in Gaza, and they're labeled WCNSF, and that stands for Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. This is a horror that Netanyahu's created on the ground, and there seems to be no way of stopping him, and only the United States has the leverage to do so.
Let's go back to sort of where we began this conversation. Why are we having these outposts? What is the raison d'être for them? As you point out, they're sitting ducks, and then it becomes an excuse to do some bombing in Iraq, which we shouldn't be doing anyway. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, why are they there? Why are they there? If they're so vulnerable, if we already have these enormous bases, the biggest bases probably in the world, then why are they there? What is the purpose, or at least the explanation for it? Because to my understanding, as I was listening to you, is that they can't even anticipate what will be thrown at them. And Iran can throw, I mean, you and I both know you can stop every kind of drone strike. All you need is one. All you need is one, and the one came through. You know, I mean, and there
And
was no point
ironically,
to it.
that one we could have stopped, but we thought it was an American drone
I
returning to the
know.
base,
I know.
which is one of the incredible ironies of all this. Now, we say they're there because of the Islamic State. That's now Iraq's problem, and it's Iran's problem. It's not our problem. In fact, we have no vital interests at stake in the Middle East whatsoever. We are now net exporters of energy. We don't need Middle Eastern oil. We don't need this relationship with Saudi Arabia. And Israel can manage its own national security without being given $4 billion of military aid each and every year. And now we're complicit with their bombing because the heavy bombs we tell them not to use are American heavy bombs. And I think the most ludicrous thing I read in all of this is to bomb Yemen. Yemen is probably one of the poorest countries in the world. I can't think of anything poorer than Yemen except for Gaza itself. And we flew these B-1 strategic bombers from Texas. That's a 12,000-mile round trip to bomb in Yemen. Now, what was the point of that? Was that a signal to Iran, you don't mess around with us, we have these big bombers? That's not what we should be saying to Iran anyway. Iran is not that strong politically. They have a government that's somewhat beleaguered by its own people. I don't think they want a wider war, but they can certainly manage these proxies. And we're trying to deal with proxies by using the kind of major military forces that you would use in a conventional war with a major power. And we should have learned in Vietnam, in Iraq, and Afghanistan, it doesn't work. And these are the lessons Netanyahu is now using with all of his massive firepower. It just doesn't work.
What's going on in Israel is not only a human catastrophe on every level, and you point out that Bibi's not going to listen to anyone, but Bibi is not only destroying the security and the safety of Israel, he's murdering Palestinians, and frankly, he's killing Joe Biden's reelect. I mean, I'm going to be brutal here. You saw what happened in Michigan. And we know that it's not going to be about the number of millions of votes that Joe Biden gets. It's where he gets the votes. And the votes are going to be how tiny? 5,000, 7,000, 10,000? And so you have so many people, especially in some of those most strategic states, that are basically, they're abandoning him. They won't, I mean, I don't know if they'll vote for Trump, but they won't vote for Joe. And
Well, when
that's
he
all
went
he
to
needs. And,
Michigan,
oh
it was
God.
interesting that he wouldn't even meet with an Arab
I know.
American group.
Why?
He knew it would be counterproductive to do so. And when you think of the election when he won in 2020, if you could maneuver 80,000 votes in that election, Donald Trump would have been reelected president of the
I
United States.
know.
That's how close all of this is. Biden has a good message, but he's a terrible messenger. He can't deliver his own message. He doesn't have that kind of impact or that
But
kind
it's
of
more than a message
threat.
now. It's our support of Bibi. That is the problem. And that isn't a message problem. And Joe Biden, I've been seeing all this, colorful language coming out of his mouth. I could out-colorful him. I mean, you should hear my language. But what he calls Bibi Netanyahu, he can't stomach him. He can't stomach him the way he can't stomach Donald Trump. But the problem is he can fight Donald Trump. He just has no capacity to basically understand that Bibi is just sort of Donald Trump without the orange, and what they're both doing together is destroying his opportunity to, one, protect democracy, to improve the economy, to deal with the climate crisis, to bring back some sort of stability on the world stage. And Bibi understands exactly what he's doing. And I think Joe Biden does too. Why is he incapable of pulling away the aid?
I think Biden has made the mistake that all Democratic presidents and all Democratic politicians, for that matter, have made, that if you give Israel all of this military support, they'll have the confidence to engage in negotiations or be more conciliatory with their Arab neighbors. And it hasn't worked. And when you
No.
look at the U.S.-Israeli relationship, I know what Israel gets from us. It's never been clear to me what we get from providing all of this support to Israel. And now it's put us in a situation where supporting a genocidal conflict in Gaza. And this allows the Arabs to unite around an issue which has always been opposition toward Israel and now opposition toward the United States. And they have good reason to do so. This idea that Blinken has that somehow he's going to get the Saudis and the Egyptians and the Jordanians on the same page. And therefore, they're going to put pressure on Israel to allow a second state in the region, which has not been a possibility for, I don't know, the last 20 years.
Yeah, it's
And
gonna say decades.
Netanyahu is committed to that. And there are forces to the right of him who could replace him, who would be even worse on this issue. This is just not going to happen. That war in Gaza must end. The ceasefire must be put in place. And frankly, I know we're not talking about Ukraine, but I would say the same thing about Ukraine. Ukraine cannot win that war. Putin cannot lose that war. But yet, when I think about what all of these regional experts are saying, and I wrote about this last week, everyone's talking about a wider war. They have no evidence for it whatsoever. But you have serious experts saying that North Korea is now on the verge of a strategic decision to go to war. In fact, some experts are saying they've already made that strategic decision. That's a really irresponsible statement to make. We have no access to any kind of North Korean politicking and how decisions are made in North Korea. We have China experts saying that there's a high level of tension, war could happen at any time. Former ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, is running around saying we've got to stop Putin in Ukraine or he's going to be attacking NATO states. Putin isn't going to be attacking NATO. Putin can't even handle the situation on his own border. He was turned back from all the conventional invasions of Kyiv and Kherson and Kharkov. He's fighting a war of terror now. So that's another war that needs to end. And we
I
have
want
to
to
be
read something from
curious
your article
about
about North Korea because I want people to hear this because I want to make sure that we sort of reinforce what you just said. You wrote, since Kim came to power in 2011, he has used his nuclear weapons program to attract attention from the West in order to engage in diplomatic negotiations. There is no reason to believe that the current test of his strategic inventory is any different at this stage. It is unlikely that Kim would make a decision to go to war without the approval of China. Just as his grandfather sought the approval of Stalin and Mao before invading the South in 1950. The last thing that China's Xi Jinping would want right now would be a regional war between North and South Korea that would bring in the United States and Japan into the war. I think we don't even understand how fragile China's economy is right now. I mean, there's a lot of discontent in China because people can't find jobs, okay? And so China is now sort of cracking down on their sort of very authoritarian tendencies anyway. And then to have this happen, I mean, it's like, this doesn't happen in a bubble. This happens with the reality of what China is facing. The last thing I think you're absolutely right about this is for North Korea to do anything in the way of going to some sort of a military sort of stance. It doesn't make sense, especially given the fragile nature of China's economy.
For the past 10 years, we've seen North Korea use its weapons programs and even its nuclear planning and its strategic planning for one of two reasons. Either they're responding to our threatening exercises with South Korea that are frightening to North Korea, or they're trying to create attention in the West, particularly in the United States, so they can engage in talks with us. They would like a dialogue with the United States. We know that from the ridiculous experiment that Trump, because he didn't know what he was doing really and had no real follow-up strategy. But we did learn that the North Koreans do want to talk to us. They would like a little more predictability and stability in this area because they can't count on Russian and Chinese support when it would really matter. And the last thing that China would want in that region is more South Korean alignment with Japan, more Japanese military power, more United States deployment of strategic submarines and strategic bombers in the region. So these are deterrents to Kim Jong-un. And the idea that he's made this drop-dead decision to go to war, well, where's the evidence
All
for
right, so let me
any of
ask
them?
you a question. I got to ask you a question because one of the things that Iran has done is that they've had sort of a number of they support a number of sort of allied fighting forces, and we know who they are. So my question is, even if you negotiate with Iran, how do you deal with the fact that they're connected to Iran because they get support, they get training, but I don't know how effective Iran would be in telling them to stop. Whether it's Hezbollah, whether it's Hamas, that's my concern is that sometimes you grow your progeny and then you can't control that progeny. I hear what you're saying about negotiations with Iran and maybe trying to figure out something. I'm not sure it's a rapprochement, but what do you do about what you have created? Because I'm not sure you have the same kind of control over them anymore.
Well, we've learned from great power third world relations that the tail often wags the dog. We've seen
Yes.
this in the case of the United States. Israel has created burdens for us.
Yeah.
We've seen it in the case of the Soviet Union and their third world struggles, where they had to respond to situations they didn't want to get into. And Iran maybe has created a monster of its own that I can't fully control. But over the weekend, Kataeb Hezbollah in Iraq, which is separate from the Hezbollah organization in Lebanon,
Right.
did say that they got the signal from Iran to stop their military actions. And they weren't fully supportive of that decision, but they were going to adhere to it. So Iran can send messages to these groups who entirely rely on financial support and weapons support from Iran. But unless you get into back channel discussions with Iran, there's no way of having any influence over these dealings.
The reason I asked this question is I'm looking at what's happening in our own country, and to a large extent, what we've created with Donald Trump and MAGA, and then I actually look at the base, which is even more reactionary than even MAGA. So in a lot of ways, what you've created is this base of voters who I think are so extreme, even more extreme than Donald Trump could ever have envisioned. And yet he created them, and I'm not sure in the long run he's going to be able to control them. And I think that's everyone keeps saying that the Republicans in Congress fear Donald Trump. They don't fear Donald Trump. They fear the base he created that are so extreme. I'm looking at that in our own country, and then I'm looking at what Iran created, and I keep wondering whether, even if we sort of create this opportunity to figure something out, will it actually make a difference for what we ultimately Iran has created? And right now, they thrive on this hostility. They thrive on this chaos. They thrive on what Bibi Netanyahu's doing in Gaza, which is the genocide. And that's the part that scares me, is that I agree with you about the conversations we should be having with Russia, the conversations we should be having with Iran. But I'm just worried right now that we've created monsters that I'm not sure we can behead.
Well, I think there are limits to what Iran can do with these groups. For okay. one thing, Iran and its influence, we're talking about influence over failed states. You know, where yes. are they influential? Syria is a failed state. Lebanon exactly. is a failed state. Good Yemen point. Is a failed state. Yeah. These groups, particularly the Islamic State groups, were defeated by military power. They don't have the territorial control and the popular control that they had, say, 10 years ago. And I think there are governments that are trying to establish themselves that know that these groups are a hindrance to any kind of stability that they want to create. But until we get into some discussions with Iran that has its own internal problems in terms of an economy that's not going anywhere and limited influence, I think, in the Middle East, because they are not Arabs. They may be Muslim. No. They're not part of the Arab League, and eventually that's yeah. going to provide limitations. But what we have to recognize, it was our misuse of military power and our duplicitous use of military power that opened the door to Iraq, Iraq's door to Iran in the first place. George W. Bush is responsible for Iran's success in Iraq, and that's not going to be easily reversed. That's true. But we don't need this kind of influence in Iraq. We don't have vital interest in the Middle East, as I said earlier. So we could walk away from this, and maybe these military strikes are designed to pave the way for that partial withdrawal, at least okay. from land-based arrangement.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you there. I think that ultimately
The hope is father to the thought in this case, but it could be possible.
All right, so let me go back to Ukraine and Russia, because what Putin has is time. And he also sees, I'm sure he's looking at the polls the way everybody else is looking at the polls. And as you just mentioned, you know, Biden may be a very effective leader, but he's a terrible deliverer of the message of his effectiveness. And unfortunately, you need to not only feel something, you need to hear something, you need to taste something, you need to touch something. And they're just not good at sort of touching all those senses. And so you keep seeing that people keep saying that Trump would be better on the economy. God, no. But people believe that because they remember before inflation, they don't remember after. And so I'm looking at that. And what incentive would Putin have to do anything in the way of negotiating some sort of an end deal with Ukraine? Why? I mean, he can say, I can wait a couple more months. I mean, it might be so destructive for those people that are trying to survive in Ukraine, but he has a good reason to hold out. And I, to a large extent, reading the political tea leaves, I wouldn't blame him.
Well, Russia is a much larger country. They have a much larger industrial yes. base. They have a much larger population. They're mobilizing more troops. The issue of mobilization in Ukraine has caused a falling out between the president of the country and the chief of staff of the joint forces. Here in the middle of the war, you have the replacement of the head of the joint staff with no idea of who his successor is going to be and when this is going to go into effect. So Ukraine is suffering some serious political losses from this right. military stalemate. I mean, it is a war of attrition now, and Ukraine cannot win a war of attrition. Russia can stick it out. And as long as NATO continues to expand on their borders, this idea that Germany is going to place a permanent brigade in Lithuania, well, that's going to resonate poorly in Russia.
Exactly,
in terms
exactly.
of the Russian population. They've been there before. They know what that scenario looks like. So how you convince Zelensky that there's no point in continuing this war is going to be very difficult, because he's got this reputation of being the new Winston Churchill. It'll be hard for any American political leader. Henry Kissinger raised this issue of the need for a ceasefire, and you saw what happened to Henry.
Exactly.
on all this.
All right, Mel Goodman, I need to let you go. Mel Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. He's also a former CIA analyst. He is the national security columnist for Counterpunch.org. The title of his piece, Why Are Our Regional Experts Expecting More War in Every Corner? Thank you so much for doing this, Mel.
Thank you, Arnie. Always good to be with you.
Always a pleasure. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. I've heard this drumbeat from the Republican Party that there is a crisis at the border, an emergency at the border. And there is a problem at the border. Our immigration laws are not good. Whether or not that rises to the level of crisis or emergency, that's subjective. But the Republicans kept insisting it did. We now learn that they never meant that. What they really meant was, we can gain from a political issue at the border. And the reason we know this is that a bipartisan group of senators, including Jim Lankford from Oklahoma, who was one of the most conservative right-wing senators on this and other issues, got together and crafted a piece of legislation. A legislation that, frankly, I don't love. It's pretty conservative. It's too conservative for me. But the Democrats in the Senate said, we can support this for the most part. The president, who was a Democrat, said, I'll sign this. And Mike Johnson of the House said, nope, it's not getting out of the House. Now, we haven't seen that through, but that's what he said. And the reason for that is that if a bill gets passed that addresses this, what they call a national emergency, it will hurt Donald Trump's reelection chances. So this never was a national emergency, according to the Republican Party. But moreover, this is evidence, once again, that at the end of the day, the Republican Party has no interest in governance. And what they are most interested in, first, last, and always, for the most part, is elevating their cult leader, Donald Trump. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
Gardens growing clean water on this current cast. When it rains, the runoff picks up pollution. Fertilizers, herbicides, and oils are carried across hard surfaces, through drains, and into our rivers, lakes, and oceans. Now people are creating rain gardens, directing storm water runoff to shallow depressions in the landscape where it's held long enough to seep into the ground. Pollutants are filtered out or broken down as they move through the soil and into the groundwater supply. With native plants, a rain garden can be a beautiful, low-maintenance, and low-cost way to attract birds and butterflies, too. Your garden may start in the gutter, but it can end up bringing clean water and new life to the land. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online.
It's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got.
Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you.
When it's 2019, but it feels like
1933. To say I'm in love with you.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Continue to record on Monday morning. My fabulous writer from Slate.com is joining us, Mark Joseph Stern. He's a senior writer at Slate. You can actually now see him on MSNBC, not just on Sunday night. And I looked at two articles that Mark had written, and both of them are very, very interesting. One I have quoted ad nauseum on this program last week, but I wanted time just to talk to him about it. And it was entitled, "A State Supreme Court Just Issued the Most Devastating Rebuke of Dobbs Yet." Oh my God, I love this decision. Anyway, and the other piece that you wrote, Mark, was "Oregon Republicans Bet It All on a Constitutional Loophole. They Just Lost Big Time." So let me welcome you back to the program and thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me on, Arnie. Always great to talk about the news, to talk about good news with you.
Oh, good news for sure. So talk to us a little bit about what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did. And then I will then share with you what I did, because I have been sort of extrapolating from their understanding of their ERA, what was in their constitution. And it really got me so excited, because I think in a lot of ways, it may be more of an answer than all the things that we are seeing a lot of states trying to do, you know, putting a protection of abortion in their legislation, putting a protection of abortion in their constitution. I think the decision is actually so important because it's so much more expansive than just a discussion of abortion. So again, let my audience know about the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, because I think their language was powerful, but their interpretation was terribly important.
Yeah. So in Pennsylvania, the state constitution has an equal rights amendment, an ERA, which was enacted in 1971. Of course, there was a push at the time to enact an ERA in the federal constitution as well. That one fell just short, but many states, including Pennsylvania, passed one. And so under the fundamental law of the state, it is unconstitutional to discriminate against any individual on the basis of sex. And a group of healthcare providers decided to launch a challenge to one of Pennsylvania's abortion restrictions and cited the ERA as their reason. And their justification here was, look, abortion is a procedure or a medication or an issue that disproportionately and overwhelmingly affects women. These laws, whether or not they were designed to discriminate against women, have the obvious effect of discriminating against women. There are no similar laws that restrict the medical freedom of men. There are no similar laws that limit the autonomy of men to control their own bodies, to make their own healthcare decisions. These laws exclusively target women, and they have a dramatically negative effect on women, you know, forcing them to carry unwanted pregnancies, to undergo all kinds of problems that arise with pregnancy, to go through the pain of labor. You know, it's just clearly a massive burden on women that it does not fall nearly so much, if at all, on men. And so the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which does lean to the left, it's elected and a majority are Democrats, they agreed with the plaintiffs in this case. And they said, yes, any restriction on abortion, including even state funding of abortion, is sex discrimination. It discriminates against women. It has the effect of burdening their lives more so than men. And that means that any restriction on abortion in this state is presumptively unconstitutional and can only survive scrutiny in the courts if the state can prove that it has been narrowly tailored to further a compelling government interest. But the mere desire to protect fetal life is not a compelling government interest. And so it seems like what the court has basically done is teed up a slew of upcoming decisions that will strike down many, many abortion restrictions within the states.
And they just ripped apart the Dobbs decision. I mean, they ripped it apart in every way, shape, or form. And again, talk a little bit about that, because they just, I mean, you can almost see the eyeball rolling. You know what I mean? Like, how could you be saying this? I mean, before, I mean, women weren't even considered equal partners. I go back to the Declaration of Independence and the writing of the original Constitution. And what does Abigail Adams say? Don't forget the ladies. And of course,
exactly.
You know,
yes.
I mean, I go back then. And if you go back then, we couldn't enter into contracts. We couldn't, I mean, all the things that were true for women. And they go back and look at this historical reference. And I'm thinking, tell me about it. We have now evolved, not devolved. But Dobbs is a devolution, not an evolution of what has happened for women and women equality.
Exactly. So part of this comes from the opinion of the court, the majority opinion, and part of this comes from an extraordinary concurring opinion by Justice Wecht. And basically, the court looks at Dobbs and says, we cannot follow the U.S. Supreme Court's reasoning in Dobbs. Why? Well, first of all, we have a different state constitution. You know, we have an Equal Rights Amendment. We have explicit protections for women. The U.S. Constitution doesn't have that. And so, you know, we just have to go our own path. But also, and this is the part that I really enjoyed just as a reader of legal opinions, the court basically says it would be unconstitutional for us to even use the same reasoning that Samuel Alito uses in Dobbs. It would be unconstitutional for us to rely on the historical sources that Samuel Alito used in Dobbs, because we have an Equal Rights Amendment that says that women are equal citizens, and all of the historical sources that Sam Alito cited to justify abortion bans were raging misogynists. Some of them literally believed that women had no rights and no legal existence or identity apart from their husband. At least one of them, who formed like the bedrock source for Alito and Dobbs, believed that women were often witches and personally oversaw the trial and execution of multiple women as witches. They believed that women were property. They believed that women had no right to participate in civic life whatsoever, not just to vote, not just to run for office, but even basic rights to free speech, to participate in democracy as it existed then. And so the court says, and again, you know, I encourage everyone to read this and Justice Wecht's concurrence. The court says, we are simply forbidden by our Equal Rights Amendment to engage in this reliance on openly misogynistic, sexist, chauvinistic figures of the past. We cannot rely solely on history without examining the context in which it arose. And the history cited by the Dobbs majority was created by sexist men to perpetuate the subjugation of women in every area of life. You know, these men thought that women could legally be raped, that there was no such thing as marital rape, that women had zero autonomy, not just to abortion, but to contraception, to healthcare, to the courts, to the law. And so the majority just closes the book on that history and says, to us, this is irrelevant. And I think that is the most powerful rebuke of Dobbs that we've seen yet. And I really appreciated the court going out on a limb to put that in the books.
I almost want a PSA. I mean, I literally want to use their, I want every woman to hear this. I want every woman to hear this. It was the most powerful thing I have read. And I celebrated it and I screamed on my Facebook page, look at how we won. I was just so elated. And I just want to read something from your article. And then I want to go to what I posted. I wrote, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's decision thus spurned Dobbs in two ways. First, the majority held that laws regulating a woman's body do discriminate on the basis of sex, a truth that has been widely understood by legal scholars for decades. And second, the majority explained that rooting women's rights in the past is itself a form of sex discrimination, perpetuating misogynistic beliefs about gender inequality by judicial decree. I mean, the whole thing is just so remarkable. But let me tell you what also got me excited was the fact that they looked at their ERA. So I said, Pennsylvania has an ERA in their constitution. I wonder what other states have ERAs in their constitution, because I want to use this as an opportunity, even if we don't win, even if there's conservative courts, I want the same freaking argument being argued in all the states. And it turns out 22 states, 22, Mark, have this. And I am screaming out to all those states, including everyone, Texas, New Hampshire. I just want people to know that. And even if we are afraid of what that Supreme Court will do, let them try. Let them argue it. And because of having read what happened in Pennsylvania, I was out of my mind. Iowa has an ERA. in their constitution. And these are very broad ERAs. There right. are some that are more limited, but these 22 states have broad ones, Mark. And I am just wondering why we're not seeing 21 other states being challenged that way. Am I being naive or what?
I guess I would just say, I think this comes down to the reality that who sits on your state Supreme Court is just as important as who sits in your governor's office and who sits in your state legislature. And in a state like New Hampshire, unfortunately, I don't think voters pay attention to the fact that it's the governor who appoints justices, who has been able to swing the New Hampshire Supreme Court to the right. And in a lot of other states, these justices are elected. In places like North Carolina, Democrats just leave that line blank for some reason. They aren't engaged. They've allowed Republicans to take over the state Supreme Court. In Iowa, it's a similar situation. The Iowa Supreme Court actually got a new majority that's going to overrule the right to abortion in its own constitution. And so I think the problem is not that this argument lacks power, as our discussion has hopefully showed. It's extraordinarily powerful. And it provides this key break with Dobbs by saying the past does not dictate the present in our state. Our constitution forbids that, right? But I think that there are just many, many conservative judges whose mission as judges has always been to abolish the right to abortion. You know, the Federalist Society ensured that an entire generation of lawyers and future judges came up in this milieu where their goal was always to abolish reproductive justice. And so I fear that these arguments, powerful as they may be, do not hold the same sway in states with ERAs like Texas, where they clearly should, but the political reality means they don't.
Having read the language of the decision in Pennsylvania, I want the fight. I want the fight. Because in a lot of ways, their decision gave me the language to challenge in all these 21 other states. And let them explain to us why they're looking at a past where women were considered chattel. Let me explain. I want them to justify their behavior. And even if I lose, one, it does two things. It reminds me exactly what you just said, that people can't leave the vote. When you vote for a Supreme Court justice, you don't leave it blank. Because suddenly it has an impact. Then suddenly you realize that the governor that you've chosen is the one that's going to select the justices. Suddenly it has an impact. The only way you connect the dots is you connect the dots, Mark. Yeah. I've been around politics way too long. I was a fellow at Harvard, and I had Bella Abzug's old office. And I used a quote from Bella Abzug as one of the sort of descriptions of the course I was going to be teaching at Kennedy School. And here is her quote. You have to lose, lose, lose to win. And I have held on to that belief over and over again. And I hear what you say, but I am looking at this decision and I want to share it with 21 other states and say, you may lose, but you better fight.
Well, so let me just add to that. There's actually some history here that I think is illuminating. So back in the 1980s, abortion providers in Pennsylvania raised a similar challenge to the very same law at issue here, which severely restricts funding of abortions by the state. And the state Supreme Court, which was conservative at the time, unanimously rejected it and held that the ERA does not protect the right to abortion, that it does not grant women reproductive autonomy, that it does not limit this kind of idea that women should be in control of their own destinies, that the Constitution has nothing to say about that. And the ERA was just about basically equal pay or whatever. Well, the people of Pennsylvania decided that they wanted a different Supreme Court. And it took a while, right? But eventually the people of Pennsylvania voted out the Republicans, voted in the Democrats. And this Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, hey, we can overturn precedent too. You know, Dobbs overturned 50 years of Roe v. Wade. Well, guess what? We can overturn 40 years of anti-abortion precedent. And that's exactly what they did. And so I do think there's a lesson here for people who live in a place like Texas who find it hopeless. It's not hopeless, but it takes a long time. And it requires the kind of grassroots energy that we have seen among progressives in Pennsylvania that needs to keep going to secure this victory, because wins don't stay won, right? And it only takes a few flips on that court to consign this opinion to the dustbin of history as well.
But I also want to remind you that since Dobbs, we've realized how expansive this repeal of Roe v. Wade is. We now are counting the number of rapes where women have been forced forced to go to term of carrying the rapist baby. We now understand how dead you have to basically be before a doctor is willing to touch you in case they need to an abortion. So in an interesting way, what has happened since Dobbs is that we are now understanding how this affects so many aspects of healthcare, how it right. affects so many aspects of the economic and social order of families, of states. And I think in a lot of ways, that's another reason why, even if it's a conservative court, you start laying the foundation for this. Because if nothing else, I'll use it against the governor in the governor's race. I'll use it when I have to like vote for a different Supreme Court justice. But unless you connect those dots, people don't always make the they don't always understand how powerful their vote is.
Well,
and it really is.
And I think it's unfortunate, but absolutely true, as you gestured at, that it really did require the reversal of Roe for a lot of people to understand just how devastating this decision was for gender equality, right?
Yes.
That while we had Roe on the books, however bad many of these abortion restrictions were, and, you know, states really played fast and loose and enacted terrible burdens, but it was still legally possible to get an abortion in almost all of the country. And so people closed their eyes to what it would look like if that weren't true. And people thought, you know, we've had these restrictions. It seems fine. It's not a big deal either way. And Dobbs comes down. And within weeks, we have women dying in Texas hospitals, being forced to go into hemorrhaging, into sepsis, because their doctors are not allowed to terminate until they are actively dying. And if they violate that law, they're in prison for 99 years. You know, we had to see on the ground what it looks like when abortion is criminalized to understand just how all-encompassing and draconian abortion bans are in reality. And so I do think it's a powerful argument that should gain more power as we move on from Dobbs. More and more people are going to have to open their eyes to the reality of this suffering and hopefully look to their state constitutions and say it doesn't have to be this way.
Oh, and I'm now calling states that don't allow for a rape exception, or the rape exception is so difficult to actually even check the box, that I'm now calling those states accomplices to rapists.
Yeah.
They are accomplices to rapists. What is a rape about? A rape is about power. What is the state doing? It is about power. And now what are they doing? They're now telling you that you should basically carry to term. There's a fabulous TikTok, and if you haven't seen it, of this young man talking about the idea of the child that is born of rape. It is unbelievable. I will send it to you. I watched it. I almost fell off the chair because it said in such a short amount of time exactly what the problem is. And we haven't said it yet. But I want to say, Texas, you are an accomplice to rapists. That's what you are. This is no longer about the law. It's basically who is your handmaiden, and it's a rapist. All right. So let's go to the second article. Oregon Republicans bet it all on a constitutional loophole. They just lost big time. And I just couldn't stop smiling because I'm thinking, well, this kicks them in the butt. So explain to everyone what happened in Oregon about this constitutional amendment, and then how the Supreme Court basically said au revoir to a bunch of Republicans who'd walked out.
So in Oregon, the state constitution requires 2/3 of each house of the legislature just to operate, just to function. You can't do anything unless 2/3 of the members are there. The Senate only has 30 members, and Republicans have long held between 10 and 14 of those seats. So they can't stop bills through the normal Democratic process. What they can do is get up and walk out of the chamber and stay out. And they have used that process, that kind of obstruction, over and over and over again through the years to block every progressive priority: a climate change bill, a gun safety bill, an assault weapons ban, a bill protecting minors' access to abortion, protecting transgender healthcare. Every Democratic priority, Republicans simply get up and walk out, and they stay out for so long, weeks, months, that Democrats, because they are the responsible governing party, have to come to the table with a compromise, because otherwise they can't pass a budget. They can't keep the state running. They can't keep the schools open. That's another thing Republicans walked out on, by the way, raising taxes to fund public schools. And so what voters did in 2022 was amend the state constitution to say, okay, look, you could walk out, but if you miss more than 10 days, then you are barred from running for re-election. So you have to leave your seat, let somebody else run for that seat, because you have defied the will of the people, the democratic process, and you're out. So this passes in 2022, right? Overwhelmingly, like more than 2/3% of the people support it. Even Republicans, many Republicans support it because regular people don't like this kind of obstruction, right? It's bad. So 2023 comes around. This amendment has been enacted. What do Republicans do when the going gets tough in the legislature? They walk out again. 10 of them walk out of the state Senate and they find a lawyer, a conservative Republican lawyer, who argues, and it's like, you really have to struggle to see this argument. I'm not going to delve too deeply into it, but they have this pedantic reading of the amendment that creates this loophole that says, oh, no. You're allowed to run for re-election. You just can't run for the next election 4 years down the road, basically because the text should have a comma. It doesn't have a comma. And so you can willfully misread it if you want. So these Republicans start filing for re-election. The Secretary of State comes in and says, whoa, you can't run for re-election. You walked out of the chair. You missed more than 10 days. You're gone. They file a lawsuit. It goes to the Oregon Supreme Court. The Oregon Supreme Court says, nice try, guys, but this text means what it says. We're going to look at literally every statement that was made about this amendment during the entire process of voting it in. No one had ever said that it creates this bizarro loophole where you can run for re-election, but you can't run in 4 years. Obviously, it means you have to vacate your seat. And so unanimously, the Oregon Supreme Court said, guys, you're out. And so many, many lawmakers, some of the 10 are retiring, but many others, including the minority leader state Senate.
I didn't know that part. That's fabulous.
Now barred from running for re-election and are vacating their seats this coming term because they're out. They're gone. And I think, look, in a way, this is another story about state Supreme Courts, isn't it? This is another story about how Oregon has a left-leaning Supreme Court. It wasn't rigged by the Federalist Society. It wasn't rigged by Republicans. So they read the text fairly. And that mattered a whole lot in the end because it means that Oregon's going to see a lot less of the obstruction that voters wanted to end through this amendment.
So my understanding is that I want to remind everyone, like in my state, senators and House members both have 2-year terms. In the state of Oregon, however, senators have 4-year terms. That's so right. They are not barred for life, but they are barred for 4 years. And I think that's this right. is really important. But in politics, 4 years is life.
There will be a successor who's come in and gotten a foothold and will want to run for re-election. I mean, the whole thing is going to be terribly messy for them. So 4 of them are out this next session. They can't run for re-election in November. The other 4 can't run for re-election in 2026. So the entire Republican caucus is really totally scrambled, all up in arms, because they had this whole plan for a line of succession. You know, these people, a lot of them have been serving for years, and now they're out of the state Senate for at least 4 years. And by the time they return, who knows what the political environment will be. So yeah, I mean, it's a pretty good story of comeuppance for some of the worst obstructionist lawmakers in the country.
Okay, so let me be awful here, because I've been around politics way too long, before you were born, I think, Mark. Anyway, and that is that there are some people who will run for the Senate as Republicans, and they'll be suicidal. And that is that they could still obstruct, they could still walk out, they just can't run for re-election. So during the 4-year term that they are actually elected, they could still use their power of being able to find 10 of them to walk out and say, well, if you decide to walk out, understand that you are stopping legislation from being passed, but you're also being politically suicidal, because then you won't go for re-election. And there are enough crazies out there. And remember, you know, in a primary, you run as a crazy, because that's the extreme. And yet, I think most people would want to basically sort of establish themselves as a power base. And you don't establish yourself as a power base if what you're doing is, you know, I'm going to do this, but that means I'm not going to be around for the future.
Right. I think that as much as Republicans wish that, you know, this will just perpetuate a cycle where everybody walks out, leaves their seat, and then returns, it looks like the people who are running for these seats now want to actually hold them for a while. You know, incumbency is a very powerful thing once you've established it. And you only need a handful of Republicans to come to the table to avoid a walkout from obstructing all business. You know, you only need 2 or 3 generally, based on exactly which election cycle it is, to work with Democrats. And I think it's worth really lifting up here. Oregon Democrats are being very reasonable. Like, they are not going out there trying to pass the most extreme lefty bills you can imagine. They're trying to pass basic stuff, school funding, reproductive rights, like Biden type wish list stuff. And for to that, Republicans have rebelled. And I just think it's clear that does not look good to voters, even those who might disagree with that policy. And it's just, I think that the era of this level of obstruction in Oregon is coming to a close.
All right, really quickly, I want to read the last paragraph. There is an interesting lesson here with implications for the effort to disqualify Donald Trump from re-election in 2024. The case illustrates why knocking a candidate off the ballot is not inherently undemocratic. Oregon Republicans, of course, did not engage in insurrection as Trump opponents claim he did, but these senators did wield their power to prevent the people's representatives from conducting the basic business of governance. It is perfectly legitimate for the citizenry to determine that an officeholder's attempt to obstruct the legislative process disqualifies them from seeking office in the future. Amen, Mark Stern. Thank you so much. It was just a great conversation and an important piece to understand what Oregon did. The article is Oregon Republicans bet it all on a constitutional loophole. They just lost big time. Thank you so much, Mr. Stern.
Thanks, Arnie. Anytime.
All right. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. Change.